We'll begin with Gary Mormino from University of South Florida in Tampa, who is a professor of history there. And as you will read on page 4 of your bio sheet, that he is co-author of a book on immigrants in Ybor City in Tampa. So let's welcome now, please, Gary Mormino.
The theme in the nick of time seems to be a relevant force today. In my own work on Ybor City, I felt many of the same imperatives trying to capture elderly Latins in the nick of time, in part inspired by people such as Stetson Kennedy. I may well have been interviewing people who were teenagers 50 years ago when Stetson was interviewing them in Ybor City. In fact, 50 years ago, in the nick of time, seems to be an appropriate metaphor. 50 years ago, Orson Welles introduced War of the Worlds, Americans and Martians seemed to be in the nick of time. And 50 years ago, a different sort of invasion was taking place. August 1st, 1939, of course, World War II began with the invasion of Poland. And then 50 years ago, the Jacksonville Journal noted still another different invasion. In October 1939, the Jacksonville Journal published a story describing a new federally financed project going on in Florida that would have far-reaching impact. Quote, "On disc that time can't destroy, a sapphire needle scratches the songs of the longshoremen and waterfront workers, which because of mechanical equipment and the juke organ are fast disappearing." Ironically, it would be still another form of technology, the telephone probably, that even had a greater impact on historians. But the paper not only detailed the technology, in this case, the bulky wire recorder, but also the interviewers, in this case, Stetson Kennedy and Robert Harrison Cook, representatives of the Florida Writers Project. Cook and Kennedy had honeycombed the hinterland and bayous in search of vanishing Floridians, turpentiners, muleskinners, juke or artists. In August 1939, Kennedy and Cook took their recording caravan to Cross City, Florida. With Zora Neale Hurston serving as liaison and scout, the party rendezvoused at the Acock and Lindsay turpentine camp. They came to hear Cole Stacy, a North Carolinian by birth, a migrant turpentiner by profession. Stacy was a drifter with a talent for remembering the sing-songs of work and play. The August 1939 encounter has been preserved on disc. When asked to sing a song, Stacy drawled graciously, "Anything at all to help the government." He proceeded to sing such favorites as, "I'm going to Georgia to work the turpentine." Unlike Mr. Lomax, I will not be singing today. The recorder captured everything that October 1939 day, including the banter between the participants. The white overseer, a woods rider, asked, "Where is that colored girl, Zora Neale Hurston, who was here? She was a pretty smart nigger." Stacy followed with political commentary of his own. "If you government men can do us any good up there in Washington, we sure will appreciate it. Tell them we ain't getting our chops down here in Florida. And you tell Claude Pepper, if he can't do no better for us than he's doing, to come back here and practice law." Kennedy, uncertain whether the political salvo had been recorded, interjected, "Say that again, Cole, so we can get it on the recorder." Stacy strode toward the microphone, paused, backed away. "Oh no," he laughed. "I know better than to say anything against the government." Well, a month later, Stetson Kennedy still took his recording caravan, this time to Miami, just a few miles from here, in Liberty City, the newly formed black district, where they interviewed 25 octogenarians and nonagenarians in an interesting institution called the Ex-Slave Club. In fact, there's a on the wall back there, there's an interesting idea. In fact, what's interesting about it is all 25 came from somewhere else, just like most of us, I guess, to Florida. But it's a real jewel that's never really been studied, this ex-slave club of Miami. One of the ex-slaves, Annie Gale, lamented, "I worked hard when I was a slave, but not so hard as I do now." Well, the Cull Stacy and Annie Gale stories encapsulate the Federal Writers Project in Florida. Never again would so many folklorists, historians, and writers canvass the peninsula in search of ex-slaves, Cuban cigar makers, Pensacola Creoles, and just plain folk. They assembled a collection of Floridiana so rich that scholars have yet to reap its potential. In fact, I think it's interesting, in just the last few years have we really begun to recognize what a treasure trove we have. It has taken 50 years to discover this great assemblage of material. If, as Arnold Toynbee contended, great challenges yield great responses, the New Deal offers evidence of the capacity of institutions for innovation. America's capacity for experimentation is illustrated in its response to the Great Depression. Today, the legacy of WPA and PWA stand evident in post office murals, libraries, and bridges. No less important were the welter of artistic and cultural programs spawned by the New Deal. The Federal Writers Project originated in the 1935 legislation, formally designated Federal Number One. Included in the WPA bill was a call to establish four art programs. Roosevelt approved the bill, including the Federal Writers Project, in September 1935, authorizing the trial expenditure of $6.2 million. Rarely was that money ever used more wisely than that 1935 program. The director of the project, Henry Alsberg, brought to the program a willingness to experiment and a disposition toward innovation. Under his tutelage, the original objective of the program, the collection of material for the American Guide series, soon became only one part of a larger artistic cultural agenda. Alsberg displayed particular sensitivity toward developing a program capable of capturing the Afro-American legacy, a collection which would include folklore, institutional studies, life histories, and slave narratives. Florida played an important role and the conception of the Florida narratives. Carita Doggett Course, the state director of the Florida Federal Writers Project, became convinced of the utility of slave interviews while earlier conducting research at Fort George Island near Jacksonville. She encouraged individuals in the Negro Writers Unit to proceed with some preliminary interviews. In March 1937, Course forwarded several of the Florida slave narratives to Washington for review by John Lomax and Sterling Brown. Quote, "I need scarcely add that I have enjoyed very much reading this batch of reminiscences from ex-slaves in Florida," replied Lomax in an April 1937 letter. "It seems to me they are of great value, and I congratulate Florida on being the first to open up this field of investigation." Lomax proceeded to draw up a standard questionnaire to, quote, "get the Negro thinking and talking about the days of slavery." Course assisted the Negro Writers Unit, such as her June 1938 letter, requesting a recording machine for Zora Neale Hurston. At its peak in 1937, the unit employed 10 blacks, although by late 1938, that number had been reduced to 3. Originally, the slave narratives and folklore collections were intended for a projected book, The Florida Negro. Sterling Brown, national editor of Negro Affairs, called for an ambitious program to research the black American experience. The much lauded The Negro in Virginia grew out of Brown's tutelage, as well as a companion volume in Georgia, Drums and Shadows. In spite of 3 revisions and the involvement of Hurston, The Florida Negro was never published. I might add that it sits at least in one place at the Florida Historical Society collection in Tampa, as well as other places in the state. I think it would be a program well worth pursuing in the future, although it has pitfalls. It is not a perfect volume. It reflects, obviously, the 1930s. The Florida Negro also represents only a fraction of a voluminous collection of Afro-American documents. As I mentioned today, the collection sits, I think the greatest single source of it sits in the Florida Historical Society Library at the University of South Florida in Tampa. In some ways, the most interesting and potentially valuable materials were not included in the projected volume, The Florida Negro, and they are filed in neatly organized manila envelopes, approximately 2,000 pages of them, organized around such topics as games, the sanctified church, turpentine, slaves of Seminole Indians, literature, reconstruction, etc. The enslavement of Florida blacks ranks as one of the major events in our state's history. Yet the story has not been easy to tell. No Florida slave left behind a diary, and few accounts of planters and mistresses have survived. In order to understand the tragedy and triumph of the freedmen, historians need to examine sources reflecting the views of masters and slaves. The slave narratives constitute the single greatest source capturing the personal experiences of ex-slaves. Compiled in 17 states between 1936 and 1938, the slave narrative collection consists of 2,538 interviews. Nearly 3% of the interviews occurred in Florida, although only 1% of those ex-slaves actually lived in Florida during slavery. Then, as now, a lot of individuals migrated to the state. In 1972, Greenwood Press published 19 volumes of ex-slave narratives, which included the 72 Florida interviews. The publication of the slave narratives was no guarantee of their immediate acceptance. Indeed, few sources have generated such emotional a debate over bias, validity, and legitimacy. Traditionally, historians have borrowed heavily from conventional sources, such as plantation diaries, slave autobiographies, newspapers, and census records. Interviews pose new problems. The slave narrative collection is not an unfiltered perspective. Over two-thirds of the Florida respondents were at least 80 years old when the interviews occurred. Nearly one-half the ex-slaves had been children, 10 years and younger, prior to emancipation. The interviews were conducted during the Great Depression, a period which aged spokesmen might look back at the more prosperous plantation South with at least some fondness. Thus, the interviews reveal much about the problems of the 1930s as about the 1850s. The nature of the interview process was another problem, illustrating the different responses ex-slaves gave to white as opposed to black interviewers. The director of Georgia's program lamented years later that her project's, quote, greatest loss was that whites conducted the interviews. Such was not the case in Florida, at least for many of the slave narratives. Throughout the South, except for Virginia, Louisiana, and Florida, whites conducted the preponderance of the slave narratives, the slave interviews. North Carolina, South Carolina, and Alabama, for instance, employed a total of one black interviewer, whereas Florida employed 10. It was likely uncomfortable for many ex-slaves to be queried by Southern whites about the lives before they became freedmen. Given such a system, the thoughtful ex-slave often preferred to opt for silence or modify what he or she wished to remember. Quote, a lot of old slaves closes the door before they tell the truth about their days of slavery, reminisced one ex-slave. Few field workers had been trained in interviewing techniques. Since the sessions were almost never sound recorded, working copies reflect the fresh memories of interviewers and editors and were often not verbatim accounts. Still, another problem was transcribing Afro-American dialect. Still, the slave interviews constitute the greatest untapped source for the study of slavery in Florida. Many of you are familiar with a book in the 1960s called Slavery in Florida by Julia Smith, This is probably the best single volume on slavery in Florida. Smith never used the slave narratives. So we really have very few professional accounts about slavery in Florida that have used these interviews done 50, 55 years ago. Many narratives were also never published in those Greenwood editions. Those interviews that have never been published still lie at the Florida Historical Society, such as, quote, interviews with old colored people in Pensacola were never published. If one expects a reading of the slave narratives to offer an unambiguous dialogue with uncluttered answers, one is mistaken. The source reflects the sources. Ex-slaves remembered lies of uncomplicated pleasure and unmitigated hell. The question has provoked the most debate relates to the harshness of slavery, more precisely the roles of the good massa and the bad massa. Ex-slaves in Florida answered this question ambivalently. Slavery can be made to appear either benign or barbaric from the ex-slaves' accounts. Lindsay Moore, for instance, a Jacksonville resident, was never asked to perform a strenuous task as long as he reigned as marble champion of his plantation. Douglas Parrish, born in Monticello, Florida, in 1850, recalled being an outstanding runner and being rewarded for his mastery of sprints. Frank Berry, who claimed Seminole blood with his African heritage, quipped, "Even in slavery, we were treated better than we are now by the white people. Even the white people didn't kill Negroes as they do now." A blind ex-slave told a white interviewer, "Those were the good old days." Bolden Hall, born in Jefferson County in 1853, felt that his master was, quote, "very good to his slaves and never whipped them unless it was absolutely necessary." "I was brought up in the Spanish way," remembered a 96-year-old veteran. "The Spanish were very good and kind to the colored folks. Pensacola in those days was one big happy family." But if ex-slaves residing in other states opted for silence on the harsher side of the slave question, Florida respondents were not so reticent. Scarcely a participant failed to conjure up some atrocity, often in graphic terms. Florida blacks recalled inquisitorial punishments. The buck and gag, where the slave was doubled about a hoe and forced to sit in the sun. The bell and stocks, where the slave would be placed in an iron halter with a bell attached to it. Alex Thompson described his master, Judge Henry of West Florida, quote, "He gave us all we wanted to eat, but he cowhided us. He had a cowhide and used to take us in a little room to whip us. His wife was even meaner to us than he was." Charlotte Martin reminisced of life in 16 Florida as the property of Judge Wilkerson. Quote, "Wilkerson was very cruel. She recalled her oldest brother being whipped to death for staging an illicit church service." She also recalled the judge's frequent visits to the slave quarters for sexual favors. Mental cruelty posed still another form of punishment. Margaret Nickerson, born in Leon County, recollected, quote, "I never saw a nigger sold, but they carried them from house to house, and I never seen them no more." A.C. Thomas, her owner in Jefferson County, threatened to sell his slaves to, quote, "poor white trash," which A.C. remembered with particular terror. Sarah Rhodes of New Smyrna recalled the post-war trauma. "Ku Klux Klan, don't talk to me about them devils. Kill the colored people." The Florida slave narratives then suggest a series of relationships developed over time based upon power and fear, dreams and nightmares, illusions and anxieties. Although Florida had relatively few large plantations, the typical ex-slave interviewed had resided on such plantations where a hierarchy of skills and personalities existed. Beyond Massa and the Great House loomed a variety of individuals who affected slaves' lives on a day-to-day basis. Victims recalled fear in encounters with the dreaded driver and overseer. Quote, "When they got rid of whipping the darkies," remembered Kate Golden, "they made a place they called hell. They tied a nigger in a crocus sack and put him on a rope over an open fire. Lucius Douglas of Madison County, quote, "The overseer would get you if you don't eat enough. You was working for him, and if he meant you to be healthy, they all had a little hell in them." Poor whites occupied a nefarious niche in the slave memory. William Sherman of Chaseville recalled that lower class whites generally rode the patrol, and woe to any slave caught without a pass. He especially remembered the, quote, "the nigger dogs" that were used specifically for catching runaway slaves. One of the cherished memories retained by ex-slaves related to faith in the black church. And I should say that these stories are rather complex. They are not all about good life and bad life. You see the whole institutional structure in these interviews. And the church represents one such institution. The Afro-American church was a syncretic evolution of Southern traditions, Christian theology, and African customs, constituting a social world for the slave. All lies, insisted Douglas Dorsey, who remembered the white preacher telling slaves to honor their masters and mistresses. "We had church once or twice a month," recollected Mary Bittes, who was interviewed by Zora Neale Hurston. "The white preacher, he wasn't no good. All he preached about was to serve the white boss, not God. The white boss paid him." The ex-slave narratives also offer much information about the social fabric of the plantation, about slave diet, about customs, about making clothes, how to make soap, substitutes for coffee, how to treat disease with folk remedies. A very, very rich variety of reminiscences in these. Mostly, I think it's important that what comes through in these slave narratives is that this plantation was a community. Slaves would probe the system and learn the subtleties of servitude and gratitude. Although educating a slave was a crime in the South, a number of ex-slaves recall learning to read and write during slavery. In Sewanee County, Colonel Martin's children secretly taught Douglas Dorsey the rudiments of reading. When Mrs. Martin discovered that secret, she struck Douglas across the face, vowing to cut off his right ear. "However far the stream flows," a Yoruba proverb promises, "it never forgets its source." Some African customs were retained by slaves long after ancestors had been snatched from the continent. Many respondents remembered jumping the broom, an African marriage rite. Festivals punctuated the agrarian lifestyles of Southerners, both black and white. Africa lived also in Southern dance, language, and cuisine, passed from generation to generation. The slave interview offers insights into chapters of Florida history, such as early cattle raising and farming. Stephen Harville, born in 1840 in Alachua County on the north side of Payne's Prairie, remembered, quote, "There was no Gainesville when I lived there. It was a farm." He maintained that on the central Florida frontier, farmers lived in a different way. There was not so many colored folk. They raised some cotton and corn, peas and potatoes, but not so much as in other places. They planted for home use, not to ship off. Harville rode the open range, assisting his master in cow breeding. Quote, "I used to be in the woods horseback 2 or 3 weeks a year. I keep his stock mostly. We had 500 to 600 cattle in the woods. They called the cattle Piney Woods cattle. We shipped them off from Tampa." Historians interested in the slave experience in general, or antebellum Florida in particular, should read the Florida narratives and the accompanying documents. The interviews suggest a number of compelling themes. First, a principal tenet emerging from the interviews is that the source of Afro-American culture sprang principally from within the slave community. The narratives offer a rich testimony to the emotional texture of slave life, reinforcing the importance of the slave community, not the big house. The Florida narratives, with its pitfalls and biases, adds to the continuing dialogue as to the nature of slavery. Ex-slaves in general describe plantation life as both benign and barbaric. The presence of black interviewers helped create an atmosphere conducive to frankness. Witness the number of candid narratives detailing beatings and punishment. The Florida narratives invite inquiry by historians who want to compare Florida to the rest of the South. In general, the ex-slaves paint a way of agrarian life similar to that of Alabama or Georgia. Large plantations, ample diet, the ominous presence of the driver and overseer. Yet there exist fascinating differences. Ex-slaves from Pensacola, St. Augustine, New Smyrna provide glimpses of deeply ingrained Creole society, where life was different. The slave narratives will enrich and amend previously held notions of Florida's peculiarities and particularities. The decades of the 1930s profoundly altered individual and institutional relationships with the federal government. The American artists keenly felt these changes. The popular phrases, art for the millions, people's art, reflected these newfound relationships. The Federal Writers Project represented one wing of a phenomenon Lewis Mumford called the cultural rediscovery of America. Warren Sussman has argued that, quote, the most persistent theme to emerge from the bulk of the literature of this period was, quote, the people. The slave narratives thus emerged from a milieu which also introduced the documentary, the photo essay, and Life magazine. Ex-slaves in Florida, previously regarded as marginal men and women, were seen as part of a new fabric of American history, part of the spirit of James Agee and Walker Evans, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary. Our next speaker is Ron Foreman from the University of Florida. Page 2 of your handout, we have a bio on him. Director of Afro-American Studies and Associate Professor of English and Graduate Studies at the University of Florida in Gainesville. So Ron Foreman will speak on the role of the Negro Writers Unit in Florida. Ron.